Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More about me at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Matthew Clark, who's a research associate at SOAS. We'll be talking about a fascinating new publication called Botanical Ecstasies, Psychoactive Plant Formulas in India and Beyond. This is a 2021 Psychedelic Press publication. All of the details will be in the course notes. Matthew, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
So, Botanical Ecstasies, what's this book about?
Well, it really has its... I studied religion and philosophy in the 1970s. Then I had a long gap when I was in Asia, mostly in India. I came back to the UK in 1997, and then I went back to SOAS in 98, and I did an MA at SOAS, during the course of that MA, I got to looking at the Vedas, not in any detail, but I realized that Soma was a big issue, the Somras, this plant, and I just started collecting notes on the topic, and at first I wasn't really sure what I was looking for, but because it was evident that this stuff, whatever it was, had been the subject of scholarly investigation for about 250 years and all these different theories. And I remember when Gordon Wasson published his seminal Soma, the Divine Mushroom of Immortality in 68, I read it in the 70s, but I'd sort of more or less forgotten about it. But I started getting interested in the topic. Actually, at the time, I was drinking ayahuasca quite regularly, quite legally, I must say, quite regularly. And it struck me during all this that they would, I thought they must be doing something like this. it had the same, because you have these groups, these group rituals, there's the chanting, the ceremony, and also in, there's, of course, vomiting with ayahuasca as well, it's a purgative. And it's used for very similar purposes in South America, as it seemed to be in from the Vedic material. So that led me on into the idea. And I think a key point, which happened sometime, I think, in the early 2000s, I was looking at the Pashupata Sutra, and there was a line in there. It said, when you're making soma or som, add tips of the kusha grass. Well, I thought, well, that's very peculiar because, you know, this looks like a formula, like adding rather than a single substance. And so on it went. And as time went on, I got more and more certain that they were using something like ayahuasca analogs. And then bit by bit, all the gaps started getting filled in. I think the defining point really in the whole thing was that up to the previous work on Soma has always assumed it's one plant. It's one substance. But if you look in the Materia Medica of India, which I started doing, then you notice that there are about 20 plants are called soma. You know, so Amrit is the other, they are often synonymous, Amrit or Som. And so you get all these plants called soma. Well, that was the first sort of major discovery. Looking at the Vedas themselves, you get the soma of the mountains, the soma of the rivers, the soma of the meadows, all these different types of soma. In the medical texts as well, Sushruti talks about 14 different kinds of soma plant. And so then I realized actually it's a multi-plant formula. It's not just one thing. It's a multi-plant formula. In support of that, and I having started looking at it in a lot more detail, I noticed that when in the South American tradition, which has been explored much more extensively for psychoactive plants because of the living culture in South America, it's been nothing like as explored in Asia as it has in South America. But in South America, they use the combination of the Banisteriopsis carpi vine for the what's called the monoamine oxidase inhibitor, and they use the chacruna plant, which has the DMT. Just in case listeners don't know about this, the way it works is that if you take a plant source of dimethyltryptamine, which is a powerful psychedelic, it just gets absorbed in the gut and there's no effect at all. But if you take a monoamine oxidase inhibitor at the same time, then that prevents the chemical from the liver breaking down the DMT and you get the dose of the psychedelic substance. But actually, there are about 80 plants now known to contain DMT and about another 80 plants known to contain monoamine oxidase inhibitors. And in fact, you can make ayahuasca analogs from numerous varieties of plants. In fact, the first time I drank what was called ayahuasca was actually made from Syrian rue for the MAOI and from Mimosa hostilis, the bark of Mimosa hostilis, which contained the DMT. So that had a full psychedelic experience, but it wasn't the plants used in South America. With this in the background, I then started looking for more clues in the text, the Indian text, and sort of pieced together some sort of a list of plants that they could have been using. So that's really how I arrived at the conclusion.
So there's tons of rich material there. Let's maybe take it piece by piece.
Yeah.
The first piece I think we might like commentary on is, okay, so soma. In the Vedic context, Vedic not sort of in this cultural sense of, you know, Indic or Orthodox Indic, but Vedic historically, within the Vedic texts and the Vedic religion, you know, what can we discern about soma from the Vedic texts?
Okay, so in the Vedic text, well, I suppose in the background of the Vedic text is this issue that the Avesta, the sacred text of the Zoroastrians, certainly the old part of the Avesta, and the early Vedic material, the Rig Veda, scholars about 100 years ago noticed the commonalities between those sets of texts. So we're talking about some sort of common root. When we look at the Vedas, and there's more material in the Avesta that can support this, but when we look in the Vedas, the two in Vedic ritual, there are about 136 kinds of Vedic ritual. The most important of the Vedic rituals are the Soma rituals. There's two central elements of Vedic religion, has been argued by some scholars, are fire offerings and the drinking of Soma. So it's extremely important. In the ninth mandala of the Rig Veda is entirely devoted to Soma hymns to Soma. It's one of the three most important deities within Vedic religion, alongside Indra and Agni, the god of the fire. So it's extremely important. In the texts themselves, in the Vedas themselves, what you see is that there are descriptions of these of the Soma plant or plants as stalks. These are bundles of stalks. There's a deal haggled with the Soma seller, who's cast as a very unsavory character, a bit like a sort of drug dealer, and there's a sort of negotiation, and he's given a cow or some gold. Anyway, the Soma stalks are acquired. Then these stalks are put on these planks covered with a reddish cow skin, and then they're pounded to get the juice out of the stalks. This is all clear from the text. The juice is extracted. It's mixed with water and then with milk. It's first offered to the deities in the Vedic ritual and then drunk by the priests. So we have a physical description of bundles of stalks that are crushed with stones in the Vedic tradition, in mortar and pestle in one place in the Rig Veda, and also in the Zoroastrian tradition, they use mortar and pestle, but it's the same kind of process, pounding stalks, extracting some sort of juice mixed with water and milk and then consumed. In the texts themselves, in the Vedas themselves, it talks about this pressed out liquid, the soma is believed by most scholars to derive from the Vedic root su, meaning something pressed out. In other words, it doesn't refer to a particular substance or particular plant. It can be translated as extracted juice. I would actually go further and say that soma was probably a sort of shortcut or a handy word for psychedelic in general. It's like a psychedelic thing. So juice is extracted. It's bitter. It's very, very bitter. It's brownish, reddish, yellowish, depending on the concoction. It's drunk at approximately 3 hourly intervals. There's a morning pressing, sometimes a noon pressing, then a sunset pressing. So approximately every 3 hours, they press this thing. They extract the juice. They drink this in rituals that last for 1 day, 3 days, 5 days, 9 days or more. Long, long rituals conducted by teams of priests. So that's the sort of physical soma, yeah, bundles of stalks with the juice extracted. As for the effects, this is more controversial. There are some scholars, some very good scholars, who believe that there's nothing psychedelic at all about the soma drink. These are scholars who primarily argue for the plant being ephedra, which is a stimulant. We could go into that later, but I don't accept that argument. And they see nothing shamanic or whatever in the descriptions of the effects in the texts. But there are some pretty interesting verses in the texts. There are descriptions of great light, of shaking, interesting, of vomiting. But particularly in the Brahmanas, you get descriptions of people purging after drinking this stuff. There's passages where it's like flying through the air, and so on. So you can't prove that these descriptions, these poetic descriptions by obviously the Kavi, the poets in the text, are of a psychedelic experience, but it looks like it. It looks like it to me. It's very important, this soma ritual. The priests used to drink it at the rituals, but participants, the Yajamana, whoever it is, might only participate once in a lifetime. It was a very expensive thing to do, requiring a huge amount of donations to the Brahmins. So that's what we can get from the Vedic texts. This, if we include information from the Avesta, it's very similar in many ways. Bundles of stalks in there collected by the women. It's sometimes described as an ordeal. Again, very similar to sort of ayahuasca kinds of reports. So yeah, this is what we learn from the texts about the substance.
You know, I find this endlessly fascinating for a variety of reasons. I find so much research that we cover on the podcast quite fascinating. And of course, my particular expertise is in the Puranas, mm-hmm. particularly the Devi Mahatmya and the epics. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, just sort of from an armchair or a generalist approach, it seems clear to me, of course, I'm not a specialist, I'm speaking as just someone who has some training in Hindu studies in general. It seems clear to me from looking at the text that there was an altered experience involved, whether we want to describe that experience as religious or psychedelic, It's clear to me that even the symbology of Agni and Soma, Agni, fiery, masculine, rational, and Soma, watery, feminine, you know, it's sort of transrational or altered states. I mean, the symbology seems clear that Soma represents something otherworldly. Mm-hmm. I was asked by a platform called Chakruna. To do a piece on Soma, just reflecting on what Soma might be, and I did sort of an analysis through the lens of Indian myth of, you know, ways in which we can make sense of what Soma is. So it's fascinating. And the other piece that I'll share, I typically don't speak about this on the podcast because we talk about scholarship, but I do a fair bit of life coaching work, life coaching for lack of a better word, really technically these days it's called spiritual counsel. So spiritually infused life coaching, you can say. People come with a variety of issues, and there have been more than one. There have been a few people who have come having had intense spiritual experiences doing ayahuasca, and what they wanted our counsel to focus on was integrating and making sense and processing the otherworldly experiences that they had. And were it not for those clients and also the very sensible, earnest spiritual adepts who choose to do ayahuasca for, you know, their own personal spiritual reasons. I haven't done ayahuasca myself, but were it not for these experiences with these clients, I would not, you know, it would be uncomfortable for me to equate psychedelic experiences with the religious experiences, but it was abundantly clear speaking to these people that they were having altered states that people can have without psychedelics if they're adepts, right? Like much of what they were describing, I've heard before. And I was utterly fascinated. And so that's not an object of research for me, but just to say that it's clear to me that ayahuasca opens the doorway for spiritual experiences to some who are ready in the right context. And I personally don't see it as a huge leap to consider, you know, the ancient Vedic priests as some kind of psychonauts in this regard as well. And could you say a bit more about why you feel that's such an untenable or problematic position to most?
Well, it's a novelty for us to think of these kinds of plant-based experiences as significant in the ancient world. But I think they were. The humans have always researched or investigated plants, particularly for non-altered states of consciousness. I really like the work of Ronald Siegel. He wrote that book called Intoxication, published in 1986, and he spent most of his career looking at the way animals, plants, birds, animals, insects, birds, all these creatures actually naturally intoxicate themselves. It's something that creatures do. It's part, and he argues that what you might call intoxication, a very sort of loaded word, is actually a biological drive in humans. And so I believe that over time, by accident, and who knows how they discovered ayahuasca in South America, but similarly in ancient Asia, at some point they actually ingested plants that produced this non-ordinary state of consciousness. And it developed into a religious cult because of the veneration for these experiences and for the plants. And my speculation, this is really a speculation, is that this may lie in the background to the development of yoga and these kinds of practices in India. In other words, techniques for entering into non-ordinary state, particularly through breathing exercises, pranayama, without the use of plants. When Stanislav Grof was prevented from his LSD research or administering LSD in the 1972, he developed holotropic breathing in order to induce these non-ordinary states of consciousness without the use of the plants, or without the use of LSD in that case. But and I think a very similar process might have happened in India of the development of these experiences using techniques, yogic techniques, rather than the plants. But I believe the impetus was the experience induced by the plants in the ancient world. Who knows how long ago? But certainly in the Vedas, in the early Vedas, they seem to be the cult is fully developed, if you like. I think another point about this is that we're talking about a very, very small number of people involved in all this. I think often our picture of the ancient world in India can be distorted because of our dependence on texts. But of course, I did a little bit of research into this. I think that Brahmins currently constitute about 4% of India's population, and historically, probably about the same. Now, it's been estimated by other scholars who've looked into this that maybe in the first migrations from Central Asia, 1,000 or 2,000 people migrated, you know, and settled in the Punjab region. We're talking about a very, very small number of people, The interesting thing is that we have a window onto their world through the text written by the Brahmins or composed by the Brahmins, subsequently written. So we have a window onto that world. We don't know what was going on in the rest of India at all. The Brahmins had no interest in anything outside their world. But I think that within the Brahmin world, which is very, very small in the ancient world, there was this initiatory cult. You got initiated into this cult. Through your family, through your father, and so on, and then there was an equivalent of an ayahuasca ritual introducing you to the non-ordinary states of consciousness. So,
lots of fascinating points there. The one important point I think worth sort of grokking is when we're studying tradition, and I see this all the time, you know, I'll tell a story, I'll tell a Purana that's sort of etched into my DNA, and folks will want a textual reference. And I have to think, if I have a textual reference, I probably do somewhere. That's different when I'm doing scholarship and I'm relying on texts, but folks will always want some sort of parchment version of lived religion. And it's our instinct as scholars, even when we're not textual scholars, what do? We study scholarship, we study secondary literature, right? Even as ethnographers. And it's sort of the bias of our particular culture, right? And I think it's important to remember that the texts that we have are teeny tiny peepholes into a vast world.
That's right. Yes.
It's abundantly clear to me that even within the Vedic Brahmanical world, there was so much lore that wasn't written down.
Yeah.
Because they weren't important enough. They were lore that everyone knew, and probably as they roasted who knows what around the Vedic fires, that they were telling each other. It's clear to me that there was a vast array of lore, but it wasn't properly liturgical. So it wasn't written into the Vedic hymns, or it wasn't a source of inspiration for the hymns. And that's, there's so much more in the Vedic world that we don't have in the hymns. And then imagine what else was going on. And I think this is why Hinduism, for lack of a better word, is so syncretic, because Brahmanism has this sort of dual penchant of A, preserving orthodoxy, but B, expanding it. So all of a sudden, you know, the text I studied is Devi Mahatmya. Nothing in me thinks that people woke up 15 centuries ago and said, let's worship a great goddess. Mm-hmm. This probably has been going on for as long as Vedic ritual, but at some point it gets folded into the Brahmanic gaze. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really fascinating point to raise, that we have a tiny peephole into this foundational strata of society. Vedic society. And what do we have? We have these hymns. The texts obviously aren't manuals. The Vedic hymns aren't manuals on how to use the hymns, you know, so who knows what they were doing? Who knows what kinds of experiences they were having? So in the book, in the publication, could you take us through the structure of the publication?
Okay, well, the my first book on this topic was the Tawney one, which was, I've got a copy here, which was, this is a much bigger book here. This is the Tawney one. That was first published in 2017. And it covers a lot more material than in Botanical Ecstasies, which is the main argument, all slimmed down. It's like as compact as possible. But in the in this book, I cover also, there are two chapters on the Greek mystery rites. And I believe the same thing was going on in Greece, but that's a whole other discussion. And I have a whole chapter on the Kukaion and what that might have been. And then I look also a bit more in detail at some of the candidates that have been proposed. In Botanical Ecstasies, what I'm doing is really, I left out all the Greek stuff, because that's a sort of separate branch, and also the detailed descriptions of some of the, or the detailed analysis of some of the other botanical suggestions. So in the Botanical Ecstasies, what I'm doing, I'm describing the, basically the eliminating the discussion of the other candidates, describing how it's a multi-plant formula. I think this is an important point. I make the comparison with, if we look in Ayurvedic texts, particularly in the canonical texts, the Sushruta and Charaka, we look in those texts, if we look at the what medical treatments comprise, in practically every case, these are multi-plant formulas, 10, 15, 20, 30 plants for any particular formula, whether it's earache or toothache or whatever it is. Also, interestingly, in folk medicinal traditions, whether it's in Asia or Africa or South America, we have a very similar situation. It's very rare that the brujo or the doctor, whoever it is, gives you one plant. It might be, but very often it's a multi-plant formula. And I think the way that arose is because, okay, if this works, and somebody says, oh, well, and this works as well, and somebody says this works, you know, so these plants get added. And I think also within these multi-plant formulas, there's a synergistic effect, so that one plant on its own might be weak, another plant on its own might be weak, and say several of them, but combined they have quite a potent effect. So I discuss quite a bit the multi-plant formula aspect of that. There's another there's a very, very quick look at a tantra, because I think that's a whole area to be explored. It's looking for multi-plant formulas in the tantras, which has never been done. Part of the problem, of course, and I encountered this all the way through, is the botanical identity of plants. I'm in absolute minefield looking at texts, because we have some of these plants. I mean, I cite one from one example. I mean, I think there's a tree called, or the plant called Karanja, has about 70 different meanings in Sanskrit. You know, it's just, so we're talking about, you know, one reference, you know, what this thing is. And then, of course, there's the vernacular languages, translations, and also the changing botanical classifications of plants, even in modern times. So what plant are we actually talking about? So these were problems. So this, on the tantra, I didn't go into all that, but I'm just making the case in one of the final chapters that there's probably a lot to find out in the tantras about multi-plant formulas. And a kind of cherry on the cake at the end was a chance meeting with Ian Baker, who's a scholar of Tibetan Buddhism. And he kindly forwarded me a draft of an article he wrote, which has not yet been published. He discovered a living Soma cult in Bengal, in Tarapit, where it's all actually still going on. Yeah, so that's more or less the book. I'd say it deals with a variety of topics, but as they've got the multi-plant formulas, I think is an important aspect of it, the Ayurvedic comparisons, and also the fact that, it's actually a living cult in India today.
I don't think it's a stretch to think of Soma as a brew, not just a plant. So the way in which we think, ayahuasca is a plant, ayahuasca is also the brew.
Yeah.
Or beer, do you want beer? You know, that could be one of a thousand different actual items, or maybe a more sattvic and apropos example, dal.
Yeah.
Like you have a specific kind of dal that you're referring to in terms of species, but then you're referring to a dish that could comprise of a variety of substances. Yeah. So I think that sort of works.
There's one very useful article that I came across by Leonti and Kazu, two Italian researchers. And they, in fact, alerted me to this, even though this was quite late in the research. I came across their article, which just confirmed what I was saying. But India's earliest preserved medical text is the Bawa manuscript from Kashmir in the 6th century. And in that text, there are two formulas for Amrit Prasha, or Amrit food, and Amrit ghee. And between those two formulas, there are around 100 plants are listed that comprise these formulas. So, multiple plant formulas. Many of the plants in those in the Bauer manuscript are not identifiable, but there are quite a few of them which are psychoactive. So it gives you the clue that that's what they are up to. Yeah.
Just for my own selfish purposes, if you're aware, do you have any sense of when Soma in the Vedic context becomes associated with Soma the moon, Chandra?
Yeah. The early Vedic references in the Rig Veda, this is all in, actually, if you're interested in the Tawny one, there's a whole section on that. There's a big footnote on that. The early Vedic references, Soma is primarily identified with the sun. And in the later Vedic period, it becomes identified with the moon. Who knows why, but it is. Yeah, so there is a transition in the late Vedic period from sun to moon. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So what drives your particular interest in this project? Was it an intellectual curiosity? Was it your own experiences? Like, you know, what motivates you to research this?
It was actually more or less by chance, the whole thing developing, because, I did my PhD on the sannyasis, but I felt after I published the book on the sannyasis and then quite a few articles, and then I felt I'd sort of done it. There was virtually nothing more to find out. And I've always been interested in lots of different things. And this Soma project, I wasn't even actually intending to write it up. I mentioned I was just keeping notes on the thing and working towards that idea of ayahuasca analogues. And then I was at a talk in London, and a friend of mine, he said, you should write about this. It's very interesting. Anyway, there was a conference coming up about 8 months later. So I thought, well, I'll just write a little paper, you know, just for the conference. But having done that, then it sort of took on a life of its own and just sort of kept going and going and going. And it's a bit of my, I suppose it's part of my character, but I just wanted to get to the bottom of it. And so I just, in the end, I read everything that has ever been, as far as I know, everything that's ever been published on Soma, you know. So it's about 800 publications, and I just sort of went through the lot to see what anybody had made in any language, what they'd made of this topic. And then having got to that point, I realized, well, I ought to expand on this small conference paper, and it turned into a book. Yeah, it's a lot more. It's never ending, because there's still a lot of things to discover. But I think that it's all. I think that the multi-plant formula is irrefutable. If you look at the say the Materia Medica, the references in the Vedas, and also there's a quote I put in the book from Fritz Stahl when he was looking at the, who's a very great scholar, you know, but when he was looking at the Avesta, he said he could not understand why there were many homers. What does he mean by many homers, you know? So I think that's an irrefutable multi-plant formula. The contentious bit really is whether it was psychedelic or not, or just some kind of stimulant. But as we were saying earlier, I mean, it looks to me from the evidence like it was a kind of entheogenic psychedelic experience that people were having.
I suppose one could take for example, Starbucks coffee, yeah. Whatever the coffee is local for anyone. I suppose, you know, one could take a stimulant all day long, but it doesn't seem likely that you'd be taking a massive stimulant around dusk, you know?
Well, The main argument against stimulants, particularly ephedra, is that, I mean, first of all, ephedra is a common plant. It's used medicinally in many countries. It's ma huang in China. Nobody reveres that plant. You know, I mean, it's the other thing about stimulants is that if you take, I mean, it's a bit like drinking espresso coffee. You know, you have one, great. Maybe you have two, but
that's my point about Starbucks at
exactly. You know, I mean, it's extremely unpleasant to drink more. And the idea of drinking like super strong coffee, you know, every whatever it's hour, you know, for several days at a time. The other thing is that it's quite clear from the Vedic texts, Vedic material, that when these people are talking about their experience, whatever it was, they're talking about it with great reverence. And also there's this death rebirth experience, which is a trope of the Soma ritual. After the ritual, the participant, the main Yajamana, he goes and has a sacred bath. And during the ritual, he becomes like a baby with his fists clenched, you know, and there is this death rebirth scenario. So of course it could be poetic imagination, but much more straightforwardly, it was an actual experience. And they are describing a classic kind of psychedelic experience rather than just an imaginary thing. And also, if you take a lot of stimulants, you're going to have a hangover afterwards. Whereas after the Soma, they're all reborn. They have this death rebirth experience. So I think there are two arguments against the stimulant. You have firstly sustained use, and secondly this hangover, was, and thirdly, of course, the lack of reverence for anything like ephedra in any culture. Yeah,
you mentioned this in passing. What do we know, if anything, about current use of Soma?
Well, in India, I thought it had disappeared completely in India. The first clue, when I was at a conference in 2015, and I got talking to one of the presenters. Who was he's an expert in Persian and Arabic. He's also a fully initiated Sufi and also very experienced with ayahuasca. And he was telling me that he was invited by Kalandar Sufis. And that was very interesting because I've actually written on Kalandar Sufis myself, the most wild of those sadhus, if you like. And he was invited to a ritual in northern Iran, not far from the area I speculate where the cult originated. And it was a full-on psychedelic ayahuasca experience. He couldn't find out much because before he participated in the ceremony, he was sworn to secrecy, so he wasn't allowed to talk about, you know, many of the details. But for me, that was a very exciting moment. We ended up going out to dinner, of course, talking half the night about this thing, because it was so interesting to meet somebody who'd participated in an ayahuasca ritual in northern Iran in recent times. So that was the first clue that I was actually, talking to him, I then became absolutely certain that even though it's anecdotal, it's one person, but I believe his account because of his experience and his expertise. So that was the first thing that confirmed it, that it's actually going on these days. And the second, as I mentioned, was this cult in northern Bengal, where they also drink soma. They manufacture soma and make it. Now, those are living cults, but there's a big gap between, say, the Bauman manuscript, 6th century, and the more modern period. Even in the Brahmanas, there are whole lists, a long list of substitute plants. I'm not sure whether they're substitute or alternative. Actually, that's an interesting thing, how you translate that, you know, whether it's substitute or alternative, what that actually means. But Brahmins have known in India for centuries that they are actually using substitute plants. Contemporary soma rituals, for example, conducted in Kerala or in Maharashtra, they use mostly this vine called Sarcostema brevistigma, which is a vine which they go out and they cut it. It's like stalks again. They do all the processes of pounding it, making the preparation, drinking it, but nothing happens. They just do the whole ritual, but nothing happens, you know, psychoactively. And they know they're using substitutes, but they don't know what the original was. So sometime, maybe around 1,000 years ago, mainstream knowledge of plant formulas disappeared from mainstream Brahmanical ritual. But of course, the ritual continued, the soma rituals continued. They still went through the preparation, but of course, nothing happened. So I thought it had disappeared completely. So I was quite excited to find out that there is a living cult of it. So it's
still, what's your marker for 1,000 years ago? Why do you say this disappeared about 1,000 years ago?
Well, only because the Bauer manuscript seems to be referring to a living use of that thing in the 6th century. So I'm adding a few more centuries on there, approximately. But who knows? It could have been continuing without a break, you know, from very, very early times in these small communities, which we just, as I say, this discovery by Ian Baker in Bengal a few years ago was very recent. I mean, nobody's ever published on this or knew about it, but of course these guys in Bengal who knows how long they've been doing it, but their formula has been passed down from father to son through the generations. They use an 84 plant formula. He was meant to be going back a couple of years ago to try and find out. We know about four of the plants they were using, but that's all. But he never got back there because of lockdown and everything else. So it seems to me that it could have been persisting in small groups throughout India, perhaps. But mainstream, what you might call mainstream Brahmins, have been using substitutes for a very long time. Yeah.
Could you conjecture that that is because the locales proper to the most ancient soma practices had shifted?
Yes. It's all quite mysterious. But as we were talking about earlier, we forget or overlook the fact that in many cultures, particularly in South Asia, I mean, knowledge is entirely transmitted orally. These things just go on and on, you know, without anybody knowing about them. If there's no text, we just don't know.
If there's one thing, if I could wave a wand and was one thing, and there's lots of things that I wish people, sometimes scholars, but more students of Indian traditions understood, it's that there are entire traditions preserved to dedicated to preserving knowledge, which is not written down.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Which I know firsthand, and so yes. So it's one has to leave room in South Asia when looking at texts. Yes. One has to leave that wiggle room in, or at least acknowledge that, and not craft an argument based entirely on the textual tradition, especially when. Especially when there are living traditions, we again we have no way of verifying how old orally preserved knowledge goes back, it's currently alive, but nevertheless, we can't think that, you know, oral lineages is a function of modernity. Clearly, knowledge has been, esoteric knowledge has been passed on for, since time immemorial, one can surmise. And so really, what do we, you know, even when studying with teachers who use texts, the texts are a prop. The texts are sort of shorthand for them to expand so much more.
That's it.
It's not in the text. And that's really, really difficult to convey to most, actually, in my personal experience, anyhow.
No, I think it's an interesting parallel there. When I was researching for the book, is that I drank ayahuasca quite a number of times with the Santo Daime Church. That's one of those Brazilian churches that run ayahuasca rituals. Well, it's several interesting things. First of all, if you look at Santo Daime rituals, they have many parallels with Vedic ritual. That's one thing. But also, if we take the Santo Daime Church, the hymns they use for their rituals, there are about around 1,000 of them altogether, collected in different volumes, a bit like the rishis of the Veda. But if you look in the collections of the hymns, you get what they refer to the ayahuasca as daimi, you know, give me, that's what it's called, daimi. But the knowledge of collecting the plants, pressing the plants, extracting the juice, making the thing, and all the rest of it, none of that is in their texts. All you see is half a dozen references to daimi in these texts. Otherwise, it's, you know, it's praise, hymns to Jesus, hymns to Mary, hymns to all these things, hymns to the sky, hymns to the flowers, and so on and so on. So a bit like the Vedas, if you came across the texts, which are the only texts of the church, these hymns, you would never have a clue about the background of the ritual and how they make the stuff and what it does and all the rest of it. So similar parallels there.
How many delicious recipes do many of us have in our families, and these recipes are not written down?
No, that's right. Yes.
It's about know-how. You study with someone, you teach it to someone. It's know-how. Because when something is written down, one runs the risk of it being taken out of context, misunderstood. And also, it's not possible to transmit know-how on paper. Otherwise, people would just need the driving book and they would get the driver's license. They wouldn't need an instructor. Exactly. They wouldn't need practicum. And there's the piece. There's the piece. The text is just the prop for experiential knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. So many threads. You mentioned something in passing, so I will. Why don't you expand to what you view to be analogs in the Greco-Roman world?
Well, in the course of looking at Soma and all this, one of the things that struck me, in fact, it's in my book. It's in the tawny one rather than in the botanical ecstasies. But I looked a bit at the eruption of the Santorini volcano. In my talks, I always talk about this because I think it's so significant. And I got the best sort of scientific stuff on that. Now, in 1613 BC, plus or minus about 10 years, scientists have absolutely conclusively established that the it's about 100 miles north of Crete in the Mediterranean, the group of islands called Santorini these days, it was Terra in the ancient Greek world, there was this massive eruption. In fact, it was the largest eruption on Earth since the last ice age, between 4 and 10 times the size of Krakatoa when that erupted in the late 19th century. It was so huge, this volcanic eruption, that the skies went black in China for 5 years. This is reported in Chinese annals. Mass starvation because all the major crops failed. The tsunami went twice around the world. 7 inches of ash fell in South Africa. You know, it was the big one. It was a big explosion. Now, scholars are well aware that around 1600 BC, there was the collapse of all these Bronze Age civilizations, all the way from the Minoan civilization collapsed in Greece, the Upper Oxus collapsed, the Indus Valley culture, which comprised at its height about 1 million people, suddenly collapsed. No invasion, no sign of warfare, just collapse of this culture. Now, scholars know that this happened, there were these mass migrations and the collapse of these Bronze Age city cultures, but why? So I think it was the eruption of the volcano that caused these migrations. Now, from Central Asia, these people who had the Soma cult started migrating. This is my hypothesis. They started migrating Some migrated to India, to the Punjab region. That's the sort of background to the Vedas and all that. Some migrated just south into Iran, and we had the Zoroastrian culture. But also in 1600 BC was the founding of Eleusis, the great temple about 15 miles from Athens. And this cult of Eleusis is known to have started in 1500 BC. There are various speculations about who founded the temple and where they came from. The best scholarly consensus is that it came from people who arrived from the north, again, indicating that sort of area. Now, the Eleusis mysteries, the mystery rites, were the template for all the other mystery cults, and I've identified about 10 to 15 of those in other parts of the Greco-Roman world. We know not much about some of these cults, but in the Eleusis was the main one. So if you wanted to become a citizen in the ancient Greek world, for example, a citizen of Athens, you had to pass through the mystery rites. That gave you the right to vote. Now, participation in the cult was only, I'd say, once in a lifetime experience for the participants. At its height, about 2,000 or 3,000 people a year were initiated. The ritual went on for a total of 9 days. The last either day or two nights, they're in the Eleusis temple. They're drinking this bitter, reddish, brownish thing served by the priest in cups. They have visions. They shake. They scream. They shout. And it's the most beatific vision, according to some of the participants, you can imagine. So it looks to me as though something was very, very similar was going on in the ancient Greco-Roman world. It was totally secret. If you spoke about what happened in the mystery rites, it was the death penalty in the Greek world. There were people actually killed for talking about what went on, or even actually arriving in the rituals by accident. Okay. So it's totally secret. But there are enough clues in the writings of the classical authors to indicate that it was a similar kind of experience that they were having. As I say, visions of light, trembling, shaking, shouting, and this beatific vision. Now, the best scholars of the ancient Greek tradition, some of the best ones, they think that there was no, again, similar to the Vedic world, there was nothing, there was no drug experience, nothing going on there. And regarding theories for what the, if it was a psychoactive formula they were drinking, the theories so far about it, they were very limited. There's it's a complicated discussion, but there are some scholars who believe that the cult was based on the use of mushrooms. But the fact is, there's no record anywhere in Greco-Roman literature of picking tens of thousands of mushrooms, which would be needed to serve 2,000 or 3,000 people, you know, in a ritual. There's no mention of that at all. And the theory that sort of persists is that the Kukaion, which is the name of the soma in the ancient Greek world, was the fungus from the ergot fungus, which grows on rye, or mostly on rye, occasionally on wheat, the ergot fungus. And this was first published in 1978. That was Wasson and Carl Ruck and Hoffman Road to Eleusis. And in there, they speculated that it was the ergot fungus. Now, the problem with the ergot fungus is that it's so toxic. It's got about 7 or 8 significant alkaloids in the fungus, but it's full of toxins, some of these alkaloids. And this is why you get St. Anthony's fire and all these kinds of experiences that people have from eating contaminated rye bread in the medieval period. And in up to relatively recent times, 1940, there was an outbreak of ergotism in France. And a lot of people got very ill and died because of eating this bread contaminated with this fungus. So there was an attempt by a couple of scholars to explain a process whereby the ergot fungus could have been cleaned up through some sort of processes, but I was very skeptical about that. So we're left in the ancient Greco-Roman world either with mushroom, if either no psychoactive substance, which is like Burkert and some of these great scholars, they say there was nothing psychoactive involved, or we're left with mushrooms, which I think is very dubious, or we're left with the ergot fungus, which I think was too toxic. And the other thing is that even if you did manage to extract, even if you did manage to clean up the ergot fungus from with these other toxins through various, there's the suggestion of use of ash and potassium, and anyway, but I'm a bit skeptical, but you're still left with lysergic acid amide. Now, that is psychoactive, but it's not great. it's called ergine also. You find that in morning glory seeds. It's used in South America and Mesoamerica for religious purposes. But again, I'm skeptical that even if you could clean it up, you're left with lysergic acid amide or LSA, which I'm skeptical about that. I think the interesting thing is that when we're looking at the possibility of ayahuasca analogs, we're looking at the use of DMT. And there is something very distinctive about DMT and psilocybin and LSD. Chemically, they're very similar, and they have this unique capacity for inducing classical mystical experience, and not some strange kind of thing, which other psychoactive plants or drugs might do. But it's very distinctive, the mystical experience induced by these chemicals. So my hypothesis is that this knowledge of the plants spread not only to India and Persia, but also to Greece. And for between 1600 BC and the end of the 4th century, there was a living cult of this in Greece as well. So, yeah.
Fascinating. Was there anything else about the book that you'd like to touch on today?
Oh, I think we've touched on a lot. I think we've covered quite a few
Great.
Different areas in that.
Great. Yeah. And one final question. Is this research that you're continuing presently?
I've come to a kind of conclusion at the moment. One of the things that frustrated my research when I was writing the book was that there are a lot of plants that are revered in India that have never been properly tested for psychoactive properties. Now, in particular, for example, the banyan, the peepal, these are very, very holy trees. And interestingly, in banyan, serotonin has been discovered in the banyan tree, serotonin. So we get, and I mentioned those tryptamine alkaloids in psilocybin and LSD and DMT, very similar in chemical structure to serotonin. Who knows whether it means anything or not? But I also got interested in kush grass, darba grass, which is prescribed, as you know, to excess in Vedic ritual. Kush darba is everywhere. You know, the gods sit on it. It's used for everything. It's a very holy thing. Any kind of ritual involving Brahmin priests, there's always bundles of kush grass, this stuff. Now, interestingly, kush grass or darba grass, which is very common in India, I picked it in the park in Delhi. I found it on a beach in Goa. It's everywhere. This looks like ordinary grass, but it's a relative of phalaris grass. And phalaris grass, some species at some places are high in DMT. So another speculation, going back to when that earlier remark I made about when you make some, I'd be sure to add tips of kush grass, that was in the Pashupata Sutra. I suspected that kush grass could also, similar to phalaris grass, have DMT in it. And there were other plants I wanted tested too, but my main difficulty was that actually I approached, what was it, 8 laboratories worldwide during the course of my research for tests. Now, unfortunately, if you want to run these phytochemical tests in laboratories, it costs a fortune. And I was quoted from one laboratory in London, like £10,000 for a test, which, you know, maybe I need 4 or 5 tests. I was way, way beyond me. And the problem was, because I'm an independent, all the laboratories they wanted, you know, if it was a university laboratory, I'm not a scientist. I was not on a research program. There was no protocol. So they said, oh, very, very interesting. Unfortunately, we can't help. So this kept happening over and over again. So because I was hoping to have a lot of these plants analyzed to make a much stronger case, particularly with peepal and banyan and these kinds of these trees and various other plants I thought would be very interesting to test. So that was slightly disappointing. But I decided that it was just too difficult for me as a non-scientist, not in a scientific department, to arrange for any of these kinds of tests. It was extremely complicated. Even bringing plants from India to England to be tested, of course, it's completely illegal. You're not allowed to bring live plants over borders. I did arrange a test of Kushgrass right in the very early days in London, but the thing went on for months and months and months and months, and the thing had completely dried out. and then the professor who was going to do the test said, oh, he couldn't do it anymore because he was too busy. So I had great difficulty testing plants. If the I think the way to take this thing forward is if somebody who has a scientific license, if you like, to look at some of these plants to see what's in them, because a lot of them have never been tested for psychoactive chemicals. So
listen, thank you. Listen, for those of you listening out there, there are scientists among you without question, perhaps ones with access to laboratories. Perhaps there are members of the public who might even contact Dr. Clark to start a GoFundMe. But clearly, without question, there'll be they would be interested in these findings, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So perhaps some of the listeners of this podcast or people they know might get in touch with you. And you never know. This podcast may actually open the door for your analysis of Kushgrass. Excellent. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you. My pleasure. Great. Thank you.
For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Matthew Clark of SOAS on a fascinating piece of research on Soma. Called Botanical Ecstasies, Psychoactive Plant Formulas in India and Beyond. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, and keep contemplating the power of Soma. Take care.